This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We begin the third day today. Which in your printouts is on page 4. And you remember there was a linkage between the second and the third day because the water began to be created on the second day but was only completed on the third day in the section that we're going to learn now. And the day is divided into two. The first part deals with the creation of the ocean and the dry land, and the second part deals with the creation of vegetation. And we'll be dealing, focusing primarily on the first part today. We'll begin the second part of the third day, and we'll continue that next week. Vayomer Elokim, and God says in verse 9, Yikovu hamayim mitachas hashumayim El Mokom Echod. Let the water collect from under the earth, from under the sky. You'll remember there was now water vapor above the sky, so to say. There was a gaseous form of water and there was a liquid form of water. God instructs that the liquid water down on earth should gather into one place. V'teiro'eh haya bosho, and the result of that is the dry land will appear. Which gives us to understand that until that time, the earth was completely covered with ocean. The earth was completely covered by water. And it was only after God gathered the water into oceans that dry land became visible. Vayihi chen, and it was in fact so. Vayikro Elohim layabasho eretz, and God called the dry land eretz, which is a term he's used already on the first day. Shemayim voretz, the day that God created heaven and earth. So Eretz forms a double purpose. Eretz means earth, the globe, and Eretz means the dry land, the Yabosha. It's only on the third day that God assigns the term Eretz to the dry land. Ulemikvei hamayim koro yamim, and the gathering of water he called oceans. Vayar Elokim ki tov, and God saw that it was good, although it's not yet the end of the third day. In the middle of the third day, God interrupts it by saying he saw that it was good, and we discussed last week that this was the end of the creation of water, that there was a reason why God could not complete the creation, or would not complete the creation of water on the second day, that in that second day, by separating the water, he was able to create the possibility of dissent, the possibility of challenge, the possibility of disobedience, which was an essential part of the man-God relationship. That being the case, he didn't want brocha on the second day, he didn't want there to be blessing, and so he left the work undone so that the blessing would be given on the third day instead of the second day. Now, there's some interesting midrashic material, and that's what we need to focus on. If we look at the verses themselves, there's not much to talk about. That's what God did. We don't know how he did it, and we can carry on reading. But the midrashic material is what makes all of this so relevant to us. And the midrash says the following. Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana b'shem Rabbi Levi Omar. Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana said in the name of Rabbi Levi, Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yikavu Li Hamayim. This word that you look, if you look in the Hebrew, the word used by God in that first instruction, Vayomer Elokim in verse 9, Yikavu Hamayim, which your English translates as, I suppose, the water should be gathered or collected, would be the right translation. Let the waters beneath heaven be gathered into one area. Yikovu, from the word mikveh. That's where the word mikveh comes from. A gathering of water, bringing water together in one place is called a mikveh. Yikovu. Let the water gather together in an enormous mikveh called an ocean. But there's another meaning, there's another shade of meaning to the word yikovu. It comes from the Israeli national anthem. Atikvah. Kivu is hope. Looking forward to something. So there's something in this gathering of the water into one place. There is also a forward-looking element, almost implying that the gathering is kind of temporary. Gather meanwhile into one place, but look forward, look ahead. What is that all about? hope and trust ahead, says God, to the water. Mashani osid lasos bohem, what I'm going to do with the water ultimately. Moshal, in the Medrash, in its normal way, tells a story. Lemelech shebono paltarim. A king builds a most beautiful residence, a beautiful palatial home. V'hoshiv b'seicho ilmim. And he had deaf people and dumb people occupying the palace, serving him. V'hoyu mashkimim v'shalim b'shloimo. These dumb people, these deaf people, would get up early in the morning to check that the king was okay, to inquire after his health. How was he? And they used to do it biramizo. They used to do it with gestures because they couldn't talk. Uve etzbo, uve manulin, and they used to use their fingers and they used to write. They used to find ways of expressing themselves, as difficult as it was to question the king, to check on the king, to take care of the king. Omar HaMelech, ilua yupichin, alachas kama v'kama. It's so beautiful to have people around that care about me, that are there for me, that first thing in the morning they're there, that serve me in this way. Imagine if they could talk, what would they say to me? They're making me feel good without even being able to talk, just by their gestures. They're making me feel valuable and important. Imagine if they could talk. Itmar, it's amazing to think, what could happen if they could talk? Hoshiv bo HaMelech diyurin pikhin. So he fired his staff, and he hired people who could talk. Clever people. Omdu v'chzika b'faltri. They got up and they took possession of the palace. Omru ein paltin zu shel melech. They said, this isn't the king's. We run the place. We manage the place. The king's just one. We're the majority. Shelonu hi, this palace is ours. Omer HaMelech tachzo paltin l'kemo shehoyso, says the king. Get rid of the clever guys. Let's get the old deaf and dumb people. It was much more pleasant. Kach mitchilas briyoso sheloilo. In the beginning, when the world was created, there was just water. And God's praise went up from the water. We'll understand in a few moments what that meant. And only from the water. That is what it says in chapter 93 of Psalms of Tehillim, which we say every Shabbat several times. Mikolos mayim rabim adirim mishbireyom. From the voices of the enormity of the oceans, the power of the waves. What is the voice? What was the voice of all that power? Umeha yu'imrim. What did the sea say? What did the ocean say with all that power? Adir ba'morim Hashem, the verse concludes, that God is powerful and glorious in the heavens. We'll explain all that in a moment. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, said God, ma'im eilu she'en lohim lo'i peh v'lo'i amiro v'lo'i dibur. If the oceans that have no mouth, they cannot speak, they cannot express themselves. Harehin mekalsinosi, they praise me. Keshe evro odo malachas, kama kama. God said in great anticipation, can you imagine what will happen when there are human beings on the earth? Can you imagine how beautiful it will be, what they'll say, how they'll express themselves? The poetry, the praise, the beauty, the tranquility. Omad der hamabul, amorad boy. The generation of the flood came and started rebelling against God, and the generation of Enosh, and the generation of the Tower of Babel. Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, yifnu eilu v'yamdu v'yavoyu oisen sh'yoshvu behem mikodem. Let us get rid of these great human beings and go back to the time, to the pre-human time, when there was nothing but water. Hadao dichtiv, that's what it says in the flood. That rain fell on the land 40 days and 40 nights. Doesn't say rain fell, it says the rain, as if there was rain set aside, as if there was a body of water that God held in reserve for that day. And the Medrash links that to the word Yikovu. God knows right now that there's not going to be a day that is so beautiful as that is right now, when there's only ocean. And there will be a time when the ocean will once again envelop the whole world. So the seeds of the flood are planted in the very creation of dry land. And we need to understand that a little bit, and in that understand the very mysterious and mystical attraction that the ocean has for people. And that mystical attraction can be measured in all sorts of ways. It can be measured in the amount of art that revolves around the ocean. the poetry and the paintings that have ocean views in them. It can be measured by the differential in the cost of real estate on the ocean as opposed from one block away from the ocean. It can be measured by the people who walk up and down in every city that is by the ocean. If the weather's good, there are thousands and thousands of people standing, walking, milling around near the ocean. People are drawn to the ocean, drawn to the ocean. I was talking to some clients today who came from another city, whose name I won't mention right now, and they were telling me the price of real estate there, and I couldn't figure out. I said, so what's the problem? Is it a terrible city to live in? They said, no, it's a great city to live in. I said, what's the downside? They were describing life there. It sounded fine. What's the downside? They said, there's no water. There's no ocean. There isn't a big river. There aren't great lakes. There's no water. People feel claustrophobic. People are attracted to the ocean. What is it that attracts them to the ocean? And it's always intrigued me, and everybody has their own theories as to why people are attracted to the ocean. But here tonight I find that not only are we attracted to the ocean, God is attracted to the ocean. That God looked at the world when it was only ocean, and he said, Yikovu. Hope for the day that it will be like this again, because until that time it won't be like this. The earth is so beautiful, covered by water. The praise of me. In some way, the ocean links us to God. And we know that is so. We know that is so from the Chazal on the mitzvah of Techeles. Why there's blue on the tzitzis that we wear. We don't wear the blue on our tzitzis because we don't know how to make it, that particular blue. But the Chazal make it very clear that part of the purpose of that blue is to remind us that that blue is the blue of the ocean. It comes from a chalazon, which is a kind of a shellfish that lives in the ocean. And the blue and the shellfish link us into the thought of the ocean. So when we're putting on our tzitzis, when we're enclosing ourselves, when we're limiting and restraining ourselves, at that very moment of restraint, I was actually talking about clothing and restraint and oceans. There's an interesting discussion on the email over the last few days. As you know, we're busy beautifying the shul on the beach, have it ready for Yom Tov, and the question came up, now that the shul is going to look so beautiful, the problem is, what about the people? When the shul was a bit of a junkyard, and the people were dressed like they just come from a junkyard, it sort of fitted in. It wasn't nice for Shabbos, but it was okay for the shul. But now that the shul's going to look nice, what about the people? So the discussion was, should we put a sign up outside that it's a shul? Dignity, it has sanctity. There's an appropriate way to dress. And somebody threw in an email and said, but there's an appropriate way to behave. It doesn't help being dressed right and to behave like a hooligan. If you're going to tell people how to be dressed, they should also be told how to behave. And that's more important than the dress. And one person who's in the shul this evening said, you don't have to do that. You will almost always find when a person is dressed appropriately, he behaves appropriately. It's very seldom that a person is sensitive enough to dress correctly for his environment and he behaves incorrectly for his environment. It starts with the dress. And when we get dressed, that's part of what we do. We are limiting ourselves. By putting on clothes, we are limiting ourselves because clothes limit what you can do and what you cannot do. If you're wearing a suit at the seaside, you're not going to go for a swim. Can't do it. If you want to go for a swim or you want to sunbathe, you've got to wear a swimming costume. So by wearing a suit, you're limiting what you can do there. And if you're walking in Rodeo Drive in a swimming costume, you're limiting yourself. There are certain hotels there and certain stores that probably won't be happy to admit you. So you're limiting yourself as to where you can go and where you cannot go, what you can do and what you cannot do. Clothing immediately limits. And the type of clothing, and tzitzis is part of that. The idea of putting on tzitzis is to impose moral limitations, to understand that at this moment, as I'm getting dressed in the morning, dressing doesn't just mean putting something on to warm me. Dressing means I am choosing the degree of restraint for my day. And many of you in business will know that you very often dress with your business day in mind. Are you going to be meeting clients today? Are you not going to be meeting clients today? Are you going to be standing in front of a group of people? Are you not? Are you going to be going out for a luncheon today? Are you not? The way you dress is determined by what you do, but what you do is determined to some degree by how you dress, because you might have come dressed inappropriately, and somebody invites you to a very special venue for lunch, and you might have to say, sorry, can't come, I'm not dressed appropriately. So not only is your dress a reflection of what you plan to do, but what you plan to do is limited to some degree by the way you've chosen to dress. And tzitzis is an acknowledgement of that limitation. That by getting dressed, I am choosing certain avenues for the day and excluding others. I'm making choices. At the time I get dressed already, I'm making choices for the day. But as we put on that limitation, there's that striking strand of blue in our tzitzis. The ocean. The sea. And with the ocean comes not only the freedom of the ocean and the boundarylessness of the ocean, but there also comes the reflection of the sky. The ocean is a very small, but the best we have, reflection of the limitlessness of the sky, of the heavens. It's the closest we can get to it, the closest we can access to it. And all of you have taken a boat out onto the ocean know what it's like. That if it's not too rough and uncomfortable, that sense, that feeling of being out there, there are no streets, there are no roads, there are no freeways, there are no traffic lights. There's just open space, absolutely open space. You can go wherever you want. Unbelievable freedom. So that at the moment of self-restriction and self-restraint expressed by the act of dressing, there is simultaneously an understanding that even in that restraint there is the possibility of enormous limitlessness. And we deal with that paradox in the way we function throughout our day. And so the ocean is an important point. When God, so to say, is attracted to the ocean, God finds in the ocean a reflection of himself. And that's what he calls the praise. What does praise mean? A reflection, to be able to look at the ocean and see some little spark of the limitlessness, of the eternity, of the infinity that is God and that is heaven. And it goes further than that. Because in the ocean itself, there is such enormous power, and that's the phrase, the posuk that the Medrash uses. Mikolos Mayim Rabim, the thunderous sound of mighty waters. Adirim, powerful. Mishbere Yom, the crashing waves of the ocean, creates the picture of power, of turbulence. But with that power, there's unbelievable peace. People look out over the ocean. They don't go over the ocean to feel power and turbulence. People go to look at the ocean to feel tranquility and calm. And isn't it interesting that you go to the source of some of the most violent power to feel the calm? You feel more calm at the ocean, watching those waves crashing against the cliffs, than you can sometimes feel in quiet fields, where they're just the sound of birds. It's a different kind of a calm. But there is a calm, there is a tranquility one can feel at the edge of the ocean that we draw out of the very power and turbulence. So that in the ocean there is not only power, but there's also peace. There is not only turbulence, but there's also tranquility. And that's godliness. Godliness is not just peace with a sense of nothing happening, emptiness, void and vacuum. That's not the revelation, that's not Hashem. Hashem is action and power and energy and dynamicism. But there's Shalom. Shalom is his name. There's peace. He's not just power and dynamicism and activity and no tranquility. That capacity to find peace in power and to find tranquility in turbulence is a function of godliness. And God designs man to be able to achieve that. God designs the human being to be capable of finding within that turbulence the tranquility. And within that power, the peace. And therefore God says, won't it be magnificent when I've got human beings that can recreate this feeling? It won't only have to be an inanimate ocean. I'll have living human beings that can choose, that can think, that can make value judgments, that can create for themselves environments that are powerful and peaceful, that are turbulent and tranquil. Human beings who understand the value of the tensions created by power and peace and by turbulence and tranquility. Won't that be magnificent? And what do the human beings do when they came? They created turbulence without the tranquility. They sought power without striving for peace. And so they corrupted the power, and they corrupted the turbulence. They lost the peace, and they lost the tranquility. And God brings the water back and covers the earth to regain that tranquility before he begins the process of the reconstruction of the world the second time after the flood of Noah. But important in that is a sense that we get from this Medrash that God almost holds the water in. Because the Medrash deals with a simple scientific question. Where did the water go to? If the water covered the whole earth, what does it mean he gathered it into one place? Where did he put it? It doesn't make scientific sense. If it covered the whole earth, then there was enough water to fill all the cavities of the ocean and cover the continents. So where did he put it? When it says, let all the water gather into an ocean, where did he put it? Where was there a place for it? Where was there a place that could hold that excess water in a way that the continents and the dry land could appear? And so the Medrash says, "Benoach sheba olam, it is normal in the world. Adam mefane kli mole betoch kli reikon. A person takes a full vessel and empties it into an empty vessel. Shema kli mole betoch kli mole. Have you ever heard of somebody emptying a full vessel into a full vessel? Kol olam kulo mayim b'mayim. The whole world was completely covered with water. Vatzoimer el mokom echod. And you, God, say, let all the water gather into one place. Which place? Where place? What place? Where is that place? What are you talking about?" So you have to say that this is one of many examples which the Medrash goes on to recount, where a small container contained a lot of content, contained more content than the volume of that container could normally be measured to be able to contain. Well, what's so clever about that? Sure, you've got to say that the world was full of water and God got the water together and there was space. What was that all about? Very interesting. Water is the only substance, to my knowledge, and I might be corrected on that, that expands when it freezes. Normally, when a liquid becomes solid, it becomes more dense. That's the difference between a liquid and a solid. A gas is the least dense. When it becomes a little more dense, it becomes a liquid. And when it becomes still more dense, it becomes a solid. Clearly here, God and the Medrash and other places makes that clear, contracted the water. Now we know scientifically that there was an ice age. I don't know enough about it to know exactly what it was. I don't know if anybody knows exactly what it was. But it's conceivable that the world was covered with ice. And God contracted the ice into a solid. And if you look at the differential between what it, into a liquid, contracted the ice into a liquid, which doesn't normally make sense. If the ice would have been contracted, it should have become more solid. That water is the only liquid that is more dense than its solid equivalent. And normally people say, well, that's God did that so the fish could survive. So that's why ice rises to the top and leaves the water at the bottom. Well, when you have a pitcher of water on your table with ice, the ice floats on the top. It shouldn't. If the ice is solid, it should fall to the bottom. Miracle. And people say it's a miracle to facilitate fish. No. That's a miracle to facilitate us. We would have nowhere to be if God couldn't have contracted the water into a smaller place, into a smaller space. So God changes the laws of physics. That's what he did on the third day. Whereas every other substance contracts, whereas every other substance expands when it becomes a liquid, God contracted water so as to make more space for the dry land. And it's as if the water is held together, and whether it was actually ice or it was just colder than it was normally, because as the water becomes warmer, so it contracts. Strangely enough, shouldn't be. Should be the other way around, up to certain temperatures. God contracts the water, creates place for the continents, for the dry land, and thereby facilitates human life. We would not be able to function if it weren't for that fact that water is a contracted form and occupies less space than it should scientifically. If you take the standard as the solid and you say ice is where you start from, now take any other substance and figure out when it becomes a liquid, how much more does it expand? That is how much space liquid water should have taken. So if the earth was covered with ice, when it became liquid, it should have been even deeper underwater. The reverse happened. And that's what gives us space to live. But it's as if God is almost holding the water back so that we can live. And what happened at the flood? He didn't bring new water. Hageshem. He simply let go. And said, okay, if you don't appreciate the dry land, just let's go. And the water expands and occupies the dry land. And so we live in a constant state of danger, so to say. That God could at any point let go. He's holding on. He's holding the water back. And we know how difficult it is to hold water back. If there's a leakage in a house, or there's moisture in a house, or there's a flood, or there's a river, there's a dike that's broken, we know how difficult it is to hold water back. God is literally holding the water back all the time by this instruction which He gave on the third day, and He keeps on repeating every day, all the time, Yikavu Amayim, the water must stay in its place. And if for one moment God would stop that instruction, we would be enveloped, we would be completely covered with water. And they talk of the melting down of the polar caps of the North and the South Pole, and what that would do to dry land. And I don't know exactly what the figures are, if it disappeared completely, if God finished the job and melted all of that ice, exactly what would happen, I don't know. But it would be pretty bad for us who live near the coast. And we live in so to say, constant danger. But that's not only with respect to water. We don't realize, as part of the blessing that God gives us, that we don't realize how we live in constant danger all the time. We think we're safe, we think we're okay, but that narrow line between life and death, the narrow line between good health and ill health, the narrow line between security and catastrophe, is such a hair's breadth. If one stops to think of it, one gets depressed and worried. So thank God we don't think about it too often. And the fact that it is so, we see how, to what extent we refuse to consider it. Because if we really considered it, I don't know that any of us would fly in an aeroplane. Just think of what little things have to go wrong for it to come out of the sky, and how many little things there are that could go wrong. Which one of us would trust our lives into that piece of technology if we really understood how easily a thing could go wrong? But we don't. We sit down and we have our drinks and we have our lunch and we complain if the kosher meals aren't on board, and we still want to be treated in luxury, and if the plane's a little bit late, we're unhappy about it, and if it lands and we're kept back a little bit before they open the doors, we start getting frustrated and angry. We're entitled to get out. Things should be working. We take it for granted. And it's so with the world. So many little things. One little thing just has to go wrong. That's the bracha we say every morning and every time we come out of relieving ourselves in the bathroom. Asher Yotzei Sodom, the way you've created us, God. One little thing has to go wrong. One little aperture that's meant to be open needs to get blocked. And one little place that's supposed to be closed needs to open, and we're dead. That's all it is. So that each moment that we function, each moment that we're okay, each moment that we're healthy, is God actually saying, I want you to be healthy, I want you to be healthy, I want you to be okay, I want you to be safe. Every moment that we have it is a blessing from Hashem. Because the normal state, naturally, we shouldn't. If you look at the statistical chances of life surviving, they're zero. It shouldn't be. We can't take it for granted because it's become normal. We see the same as the airplanes fly, they go, they come back, they land. We take it for granted, we think it's normal. And then a Concorde, just because a little piece of rubber flies off, a tire bursts, and the whole thing goes up in flames. And then you realize, what are the chances of tires bursting? We know how often, look what's happening with the Firestones, how often it can happen, how easy it can happen for tires to go wrong. But they don't normally go wrong. Each time they don't go wrong. A blessing from God. He wants those people to be safe. Each time we wake up in the morning, a blessing from God. He wants us to be safe. He wants us to be healthy. And instead of looking at when things go wrong and say, oh goodness, why is God doing this to me? Our focus is meant to be every day to say, oh my goodness, why is God being so good to me? What does He want from me now? What is He demanding from me? That He's blessing me and He's taking care of me day after day. What am I supposed to be doing today that would make me worthy of that blessing? That's meant to be our focus. And that applies even to the fact that we have land, earth to walk on. And that's why one of the brachas we say every morning is Roika Ha'oretz Al Hamoyim. Thank you, God, for keeping dry land space for us. Just having continents on which to walk. Just having earth on which to settle. Each day we say it. We don't say it once. Every day it's a new bracha, because every day God could release his control over the water. And if he does that, there is no dry land. And it's for that reason that the Ramban said, and we quoted it last week, that it's at this point that God calls the dry land Eretz, which is the word he uses for the word he uses for the globe. Shemayim v'Eretz, the beginning. In the beginning when God created heaven and earth. Earth, the globe earth, is also called Eretz. And now God calls the dry land on which we walk Eretz. Why is that so? Explains the Ramban. Aval yikrois or Eretz g'shem klal ha-yesoides ha-nivra barishon. God calls dry land Eretz, using the same word he uses on the first day for the totality of all of matter. Ba'atam, and the reason is, ki ba'avuro nivru sh'tiye yishuv la'odom. Because all of matter was created so that there should be a place for human beings to live. She'en betachtoinin makir boiro zolosoi. Because there is no creature in this world that understands God as a human being does. And therefore the only purpose in the whole Bria is human beings, and human beings need land. And so God calls the land Eretz, because the whole essence of the total globe of all of matter depends on the human capacity to flourish on dry land. Without that capacity, there is no meaning. If there is no dry land, there are no people. If there is no people, there is no purpose in life, and there is no purpose in this whole thing existing. And therefore God calls that Eretz, so that we should understand the value of earth. And it's interesting that we stand on the dry land and we gaze longingly out at the ocean. And if we can manage it, we get onto that ocean and we go overseas, or we get onto a boat and we go for a trip on one of these vacations, almost to escape from the dry land to get to the ocean. And yet it's the dry land that is called Eretz. The ocean is there to facilitate life on dry land. It's not the other way around. The dry land is not the ancillary. Dry land is the essence of the whole creation, because it's on dry land that the human being can flourish. And so God reduces contracts the content to facilitate it being contained in a small container, and that's the source of life. And herein lies an enormous lesson, that without that contraction there would be no life. And what does the contraction teach us? More content than container. Empty vessels make a lot of noise, but they're empty. And life is about filling the container fuller than it can possibly contain, actually contracting the material, making it more dense, so that there is far more content than one would evaluate from looking at the outside of the container. That means when you see something from the outside and you evaluate what's inside it, when you get inside, you should be astonished with how much you undervalued what it was, because there is so much more inside than you could ever have dreamed of. That's what sustains life. Life is about over-delivering on the content and under-delivering on the container. Our lives and our society have become about over-delivering on the container and under-delivering on the content. A lot of the advertising, the truth is, if content was fuller than the container, you wouldn't need advertisements, because the content would advertise for itself. It would get around very quickly that this particular product or this particular service, the content is far greater than the container, and you wouldn't need to advertise. We need to advertise because we try and get away with big containers and little content, and we try and dupe people into thinking that they're getting value. But it is only value when there's more content than container. That's life. We wouldn't be here if God didn't follow that principle. If God didn't make the content dense, incredibly dense, so that it could fit into a small container, and the glory is not in the container, the glory is in the content, if it wasn't for that, there wouldn't be space. There wouldn't be place. And the Gemara says that God says that I and a Baal Gaiva, I and an arrogant person, cannot live in the same world. There isn't place for us. To create place for man, God had to contract the water. To create place for God, we have to contract ourselves. By making ourselves and our content dense, packing it tight, putting as much as we can inside it, we create space. We create delight for those who then find the content, and we create space outside of that content for God to be there too. And so the Yikovu Amayim, contracting the water into one place, in order to make place for life, teaches us a moral principle that we carry on throughout the Torah and throughout of existence, that life can only be sustained where people are making content far denser than the volume of the container that contains it. Let's go one step further in this. The Midrash says the following too. That when God got this water together and gathered it in one place, Tnai hitno HaKadosh Baruch Hu im hayom, God made a deal with the ocean. Once again, we see in this word Yikovu something about the future. You need to gather into one place now, but there's something about the future ocean that you need to keep in mind. What was the deal? Sheyehe nikro lifnei Yisroel. That when the Jews need the sea to split that ocean, you'll split. So I'm gathering you together in one massive ocean, but there will be a time I'm going to have to ask you to split and to make place for the Jewish people, and I'm programming that into the Brio now. The Rambam and others explain, there's a beautiful Akedo that explains that there are two levels of nature. There is day-to-day nature, primary nature, and secondary nature. But they're both natural. Primary nature is what we see happen every day. The sunrise, the sunset, laws of gravity, the ocean's where it's supposed to be. Secondary nature is a secondary program that God built into the creation to facilitate miracles at certain times. So those miracles were not deviations from the creation. They were programmed into the creation from the very beginning. And the Midrash goes on to say, not only did he make a deal with the sea about splitting, but he made a number of different deals. Loim ayom bilvadit no HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Not only with the sea did God make a deal, Elohim kol ma shenivro b'sheshis yemei bereshis, but with everything that was created during the 6 days of creation, God made a deal. And the Midrash goes on to enumerate 7 deals that God made. I'm going to run through them very quickly and then analyze why those 7. The first one is the ocean to be to the sea to split when the Jews would need it to split. The second one, that when Moshe gave his final speech, which we're going to read on Shabbos Shuvah Ha'azinu, he made a deal that Sheyishtaku Shomayim Va'oretz, that the heavens and the earth will keep silent while Moshe is speaking, whatever that means. Second miracle. Third one is that the sun and the moon would stand still when Yeshua instructed them to do that in Gibeon. Yeshua was fighting a battle. He needed more daylight. He was running out of daylight hours. He turned to the sun and he said, "Stop in your tracks." And the sun stopped. God arranged that, programmed that from Bereshis. The third one. The fourth one is that the ravens would bring food to Eliyahu when he was hiding away. The fifth one is that when Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were thrown into a furnace, they wouldn't be damaged. The sixth one is that when Daniel was thrown into a lion's den, he wouldn't be eaten. And the seventh one is that Yechezkel, and then more particularly when Yonah prayed to be relieved from the fish that ate him, that the fish relieved him and spat him out. Why those 7? The Tiferet Tzion goes through those 7 and says those are the 7 areas of life that function miraculously. It's not just 7 miracles that took place once. Those are 7 areas that function miraculously, and God built those miracles into the Bria at the time of the creation. What are the 7 areas? The first one is when God needs to reveal himself. When people need to know for sure that there's a God, they are justified in questioning it. Then God will do something miraculous like splitting the sea so as to establish a permanence of belief, a basis for belief that the people can handle. And that was done at the time of the splitting of the sea, and is done from time to time again, although the Ramban claims it was only done then, it didn't have to happen again once they came to the land of Israel. But the principle there is God built into the Bria the capacity to do miracles so as to convince humanity that God is true. That's one situation. The second one, Ha'azina with Moshe, is the study of Torah. that the way people who are truly dedicated to true study of Torah earn a living is miraculous. It defies normal laws of economics. And we've seen that generation after generation, including the current generation. It's true that some of the young people who are learning in yeshivas and kollelim manage to earn a living not so miraculously. What's miraculous is that their parents and parents-in-law still earn a living, because that's what supports them. But it isn't only that. 10, 15 years ago, financial doom was predicted for the yeshiva world. Because people weren't earning a living, they weren't going to college, they weren't getting degrees, they were all going to yeshiva. When you get into a second or a third generation, there'll be no parents and parents-in-law to support them. The fact is, there's a whole industry that has grown up around them. They've created industries. Not only have they managed to earn a living, they've actually created industries. And you know what? Most of them are living pretty well, considering. They're living in quite expensive real estate, some of it paid off. And not always by parents and parents-in-law. How do they manage? Where does it come from? Very difficult to figure it out. And you'll hear miraculous stories. Go and spend a Shabbos in Yerushalayim, and it's unlikely that you'll go through the Shabbos without hearing at least one story that is from the person to whom it happened. Not Bobby Mises, from the person to whom it happened. The most unbelievable stories of divine intervention in the area of coping, managing financially among people who truly dedicated to true study of Torah. That's an area of miracle that God built into the Bria. Just as when Moshe taught the Torah, heaven and earth stopped. That means the laws of nature were suspended. There is a different system that governs the way B'nai Torah, the way true students of Torah are able to function and earn a living. Different laws govern them. The third one is Eretz Israel, the state of Israel, the land of Israel. Different laws govern it. By all the laws of politics and sociology and military laws, if you just take modern history, don't have to go back into old times, Israel should not exist. The military superiority of its neighbors, the number of times it's been attacked, the lack of support that it receives, the fact that it has no resources. It's particularly in its earlier years, the Six-Day War and the Yom Kippur War, the War of Independence. Unbelievable miracle that it should exist. But the biggest miracle of all is happening right now. Much bigger than the War of Independence. We have a man who's clever enough to have been appointed with an important majority as Prime Minister of Israel, and stupid enough to offer Israel on a platter to the Arabs. That's not a miracle. That's a tragedy. The miracle is the Arabs haven't accepted. That's a miracle. That is an absolute miracle. They have been offered on a platter what they fought four wars for. They've been offered much more than they gained than they hoped to gain in those wars. They've been offered it all. The fact is, they've been offered everything. Take the whole of Israel, is what he has said. If you read it carefully, take it all. Because if you give away Yerushalayim, the Mochem Beis Hamikdash, what's it all for? What do you need it for? Where are you? You give them back the Golan Heights. They've got complete control of every strategic point. They've got it all. They've got everything they could possibly want. For the most absurd reasons that nobody can really understand, the Arabs have said, no thank you. Miracle. Absolute miracle. That we should be saved from the stupidity of a clever prime minister by even more stupid Arabs. It's just completely, it doesn't make any kind of sense. If he was clever, he wouldn't have offered it. And if they were clever, they would have accepted it. Neither of them are clever. That's a miracle. Eretz Israel doesn't function by normal laws. By normal laws, we shouldn't have an Israel. That's a miracle. And that was instituted with Yeshua, who was fighting for the land of Israel. When he said sun and moon stand still, what he's saying is laws of nature suspend when it comes to the issues of Israel. This land won't exist by normal laws of nature, and God built that into the Bria. He built that into the creation. The fourth one was Eliyahu Anovi, was the birds bringing food to Eliyahu. That says the Tiferet Zion is earning a living altogether. Just the fact that people earn a living doing some of the things that they do is also miraculous. That not only is there a special miracle for people who are learning Torah, that the way they survive is not by normal economics. Even normal economics is miraculous when you actually figure it out. Sometimes it makes sense what people are doing, but sometimes when you think of it, and you think of the relationship sometimes of effort to reward, and you think of the tenuousness of some business schemes and business ideas, and you sometimes walk into people's little shops and you try and figure out how much stock have they got, and you stand there for a while and watch the number of people that come in and come out. It's not possible shops figure out how they make a living, but some of them do incredibly well from those little falafel stores. Who knows how that happens? And so now in our day-to-day businesses, the fact that a deal should come off, the fact that we should be in the right place at the right time, the fact that a buyer or a counterpart or a client should choose a particular individual out of the multitude of competitive alternatives, all of that is miraculous. That's all governed by miracle. Economics itself is miracle. The fact that everybody manages to earn a living, a few exceptions, but basically it doesn't matter how many competitors there are, it doesn't matter how big the market is and the opportunities are, both opportunities and challenges, it somehow works. People have made a living during all these years. People have generally somehow made a living. Miracle, absolute miracle. The fifth one, Hananya, Mishael, and Azariah in the furnace of fire, is that tzaddikim, righteous people who've managed to completely master their natural selves and are masters over their nature and can dominate their nature and completely control their nature, God treats them with miracles as well. If they have mastered their nature, they've mastered not only their own nature, but the nature around them as well. And they can actually insulate themselves from damage and danger from around and about them. And in a funny kind of sense, we understand that. But if a human being is healthy, the way he avoids becoming ill is that his own body is able to resist the infection. Not as if he doesn't get the infection. See, these things are flying around the world. They get everybody. But if one has it within oneself, the strength to withstand them, one isn't impacted by them. So, theoretically, if one has the strength within oneself to completely master one's nature morally, to absolute totality, then even such a thing as fire wouldn't affect us. Just as germs don't affect a healthy body, so fire would not affect a healthy soul. And Hananya, Mishael, and Azariah teach us that miracle is used to protect people who are very great tzaddikim. And Daniel, the lion's den, that's a person who mispalil mitzorosa. Can you imagine how Daniel davened, how he prayed when he was thrown into that den and was confronted by a hungry lion? And perhaps only those who've been to Africa and been to in close quarters with hungry lions have a sense of what that must feel like, and the danger that is in such a moment. And he must have prayed to God with all his heart at that moment. And this comes to teach us, God built into the Bria, built into nature, that when man prays with unbelievable dedication and focus and concentration, God will change nature to save him. And the final one, Yonah sitting inside the fish in Yechezkel, were cases of teshuva, which is appropriate for this time of the year, that when one again masters one's nature and acts in an almost supernatural way by doing teshuva, by repenting, by reliving the past and redesigning the past in order to refocus the future, God responds with miracles too. And God helps one re-engineer and redesign the future if we enter it with a redesign of the past using the mechanisms and the principles of teshuva. And so says the Medrash, it wasn't only the sea when God said, Yikovu, I am gathering you together, ocean, but with a tikva, with a look at the future, with an understanding that there will be times in the future when nature will be changed. I'm creating nature, but I'm also programming nature to be changed. There's seven situations for which I'm creating the opportunity for the change of nature. And that we need to know from the outset, that when these conditions exist, I will call on nature to compromise itself. I will call on nature to change itself in order to facilitate the needs of people who fit into these seven categories. That took place as part of the Yikovu Hamayim. Nature gathered together. Water, contract yourself into one place. But there will be times in the future where you'll have to expand in flood, where you'll have to contract even more to create dry land in the sea, and where different parts of nature will have to compromise their essence in order to facilitate the salvation of great human beings who are in a state of need in accordance with one of those seven principles. And so when God had done that and had established the principle, not only the existence of dry land, but the principle that life is sustained through filling containers with more content than they can contain. That's how dry land is sustained. We make space for each other by creating dense content. that we create opportunity for each other by filling containers to the very top and contracting the content to such a point that the container is able to contain so much more than one would have thought. When God is able to take the ocean and contract it into one place to create dry land, which gives the opportunity for the sustenance of human life, God turns to himself, sees the earth in that way, no human beings yet, but he understands and sees the capacity for human life. Vayar Elokim ki tov. And God saw what he did. He saw the stage of creation that he'd reached in the middle of this third day, and saw ki tov, that it in fact was good. And we are now at the end of the year, not at the end of our series, but between this Monday night and next Monday night, of course, is Rosh Hashanah, and it's an opportunity to wish all of you a very happy, healthy new year, that the kind of dangers that we talked about, that we're all subject to every moment of our lives, continue to be kept away from us and from our families and dear ones, that God continues to protect us and to bless us well into the new year and to future years to come. Thank you very much for joining us, for learning with us on each of these Monday nights, and participating and adding. There's no question that a shiur is the creation not only of the person who's giving it, but also of the people who are listening to it. A lot of the shiur is spontaneous. A lot of the shiur comes out based on the faces that I see around, the intelligence of the faces that I see around, the focus of attention of the faces. That has a great deal of impact on the shiur, quite apart from the Kabbalistic concept that the shiur is designed for the people who are there, who are present. So when one gives a shiur, one has assistance from God. It's probably the eighth area of miracle, or it might be included in the second one for Talmud Torah, for the learning of Torah, that there is no question that there is far greater siyata dishmaya, there's far greater guidance and help from God when one is preparing and delivering Torah for a group of people who God counts as worthy, than if one were just learning on one's own. Somebody asked Maharsha Shiva of Chaim Shmuelevitz, one of the greatest intellects and minds of Torah knowledge at that time, and he used to learn always with a chavrusa. He never used to learn alone, and his chavrusas were never the best guys in the yeshiva. They were sometimes quite mediocre, and he would sit and learn with another boy, and they would stand in the base of Medrash like two talmidim, like two of the students of the yeshiva, and they would learn together. And somebody once asked him why he does that, and he said, for the siyata dishmaya, one gets far more blessing when you're learning with somebody who needs it, so that you're not just learning for yourself, there's a giving in the learning as well. And he chose very fine boys to learn with, not always the most intelligent and not always the most independent in learning. He chose very fine people who God would value and who needed his input, so that God would bless the learning process and enable him to innovate new ideas and to think in new ways that he might not otherwise be able to do. And the same applies on different levels here, that I thank you not only for attending, but for facilitating God's guidance as much as it's been and is in preparing the shiur, delivering the shiur, developing some new ideas which we're able to share together. And I hope that it impacts on you, on the way you think, on the way you feel, and on the way you live, in the way that I hope that it impacts on me and myself. A happy new year to you all, and next Monday night, although it will be just after the fast of Gedalia, we will have a shiur, and look forward to seeing you then.
Amen.